Now, the British Expeditionary Force sent to France in the late summer of 1914 has been referred to as the best birdwatching army ever sent to war. For amongst its ranks were hundreds of both amateur and professional ornithologists. Here to tell us the role of birds in World War One, welcome to the show, Nicholas Milton.
Hi, it's very nice to be here.
Can you hear me okay, Nicholas?
I can indeed, yes.
Excellent, excellent. So why was this then? What was it? What was ornithology to do with the war?
Well, both my grandfathers were in the First World War, and so I've always been fascinated by ornithology. I was a very keen bird watcher growing up, and what I suppose I learned was that a lot of the films and the portrayals that we see of World War One, you know, you always have no man's land, you have nothing living in it, you know, you just have huge great craters and dead, you know, horses and stuff like that. But well, it wasn't like that at all. Actually, there was a huge number of birds at the front throughout World War One, we know this because there were, as you said, when the British Expeditionary Force went across in the summer of 1914, there were hundreds of professional and amateur bird watchers there, and obviously they soon got stuck in static warfare. You know, they were in those trenches and they didn't move very much, as we all know. But what they did find all around them was a huge amount of bird life. And so in the middle of no man's land there, you would have had partridges going around, you would have had hen harriers going up and down, you would have had overhead, you would have had skylarks singing, and a huge number of birds immediately behind the lines as well in the woods and things where they had all the big howitzers and guns, and they were pounding the German lines. And what was amazing was with their letters home, a lot of these bird watchers started to write about the birds that they'd seen at the front. And soon, it became more than just a hobby. It was solace. It was sort of looking to nature to, give them hope in what was an utterly, hopeless situation. And also there was a, apart from going over the top, when of course, you know, we all know what that entailed, there was an awful lot of hanging around in the trenches, an awful lot of boredom. And watching birds and recording the birds that they saw gave Tommies something to do as well. It soon started to rank as one of the most popular hobbies, you know, on a par with writing, you know, smoking, doing games and shooting rats, which was the other hobbies that a lot of the troops who were stuck in the trenches had to do.
Yeah. Well, you are right. I mean, it was the no man's land part, wasn't it, where they were just, like you say, waiting to go over the top. And it must have been nerve-wracking, frightening, but boring as well, just waiting.
Absolutely. And, you know, they used to do things like, you know, used to go on reconnaissance missions at night, as I'm sure you're aware. You know, when nightfall used to come, they used to send some of them out to see what was happening on the other side. And there's a really nice bit in the book where they come across, obviously, there's these huge, great craters everywhere, and they're full of water. And this actually attracted quite a lot of birds, and they come across these redshank. Now, redshank are, if you're a bird watcher, they have a very they have an alarm call that's very loud. So when you come across them, they go up quickly and they make a very loud sound. And this would have given them away. And he said, in the letter back to his family, which I report on in the book, you know, how lucky it was that these birds didn't do that. They carried on feeding. So he left them alone. But that was extremely lucky. But there were owls going up and down all the time. There was a huge number of rats and mice and things in the trenches that attracted a lot of birds of prey. But there was a red letter bird for all of the troops serving in the trenches in the First World War. It was a bird called a golden aura. It's a really exotic black and yellow bird with a very fluty whistle, much more reminiscent of sort of tropical lands. And that was absolutely the bird that they all wanted to see. And sure enough, it was, you know, that soon began to feature in the letters home. So they saw some exotic birds as well. And ironically, that part of France became the most bird-watched part of the world at that particular time. And we've got some really good records from there. So it was in between all that desolation and that absolutely awful, you know, you can't believe the you know, still over 100 years on, you know, we look at it and we wince, I think, at the amount of young men in particular that just died there so needlessly. But in between all of that, nature was carrying on. Nature was, you know, nature was taking advantage of the of a lot of the a lot of the trench digging and stuff like that, and was and as I said, gave solace and hope to a generation of bird watchers who had very little else to look forward to.
Yeah, you can always rely on Mother Nature. But I'm glad that they did write home about them and document them, because otherwise the knowledge would have died with them, wouldn't it?
It would. And what soon started happening was they soon started getting these letters started getting picked up in the national newspapers, you know, the Telegraph and the Mail and others started printing them. And then the bird organisations, the RSPB, who, when the war had come along, had taken relatively little interest in it. They were worried that it might affect migrating birds to Britain. But these letters started appearing. And so they, in their magazine, Bird Notes and News, their quarterly magazine, they soon started a roundup from the trenches. And then all of these bird reports started getting put in there. So the RSPB played a sort of key role during the war, in terms of, bringing all this together. And it is amazing. And I suppose one of the reasons I wrote it was, the film 1917 was on again over Christmas, and there's a very pivotal bit at the end there. I don't know if your listeners will know that, that they're in the wood right at the end. He's just delivered the message that's going to stop them going over the top and being slaughtered, and they're in the wood just before dawn. And it's absolutely silent in the film. Now, we know from the letters home that wood would have been absolutely... would have been alive with birdsong, because they, with nightingales and with blackbirds and with all sorts of different species, because actually the war didn't really affect them that much, despite all the guns and the pounding, they carried on. And obviously if a bird was caught in the line of fire, that was the end of it. But basically, while we were busy killing ourselves, nature just sort of carried on and doing what it does best, which is thriving under the most difficult circumstances that humans can create.
Yeah. I was reading about the, presumably, the then Foreign Secretary, Edward Grey. Apparently he worked tirelessly to preserve peace, but ended up convincing the House of Commons that birds were his hinterland.
Yes, they absolutely were. Yes, so he was the one who was the very famous man who said, lights are going out all over Europe, we shan't see them lit again in our lifetime, about the First World War, which came to sum up horrors and the slaughter of that. But birds were absolutely, yes, his hinterland. So he had a cottage on the Itchen in Wiltshire, and he used to go there every Friday, and he recorded all the birds that he saw there with his wife, and they kept a diary. He also had an ancestral home called Fallandon Hall up in Northumberland, and he had his own collection of wildfowl there. He was an early precursor to somebody like Peter Scott. He had quite a big collection, which again took its toll in the war. But he, and to give him respite, he used to walk around St James's Park and look at the birds there, just to have some small peace from the war. But yes, birds were absolutely his hinterland.
Yeah, and I'm guessing these soldiers would have been relatively young, wouldn't they? Sort of in their teens, maybe.
Oh, awful, yes. Sort of the average age was around about 19, Yeah. And so some of them were older, but that was around about the sort of age. And there's I've done in the back of the book, there's an ornithological roll of honour. There's about 40-odd people in there. There were a lot more, but these were the stories that I could piece together. Of very young men who died during the war. There was a private, Maxwell Green, who was 19. He was shot straight through the head in Ypres in April 1915. So put his head above and got a bullet straight through his temple, killed him instantly. And on his body was found, he'd been scribbling down the birds he'd seen on tiny little scraps of paper. And it was in the Selborne Society magazine, and it was on him, and they returned it to his father, and his father sent it off to the Selborne Society magazine, and they published it. Just these tiny little scraps. He said, "Yeah, this is it's with melancholy." that I published the following, and it gave him something else to do, something else to think about, something to do other than, you know, and it helped them, I think, blank out what was truly, you know, what was happening all around them, which was every day they were seeing people killed under the most awful circumstances.
Yeah, it's unimaginable, it really is. And how did you do your research, Nicholas, from such a long time ago?
Well, the Imperial War Museum have a fantastic database that I access, so that was really good. And I went back over all the old papers and journals, as I say, you know, the RSPB's notes and news was great, because they started this regular column, which sort of expanded as the war got on, as the war went on. And so I drew, you know, a lot of the stories and the anecdotes from there. But also people like you mentioned, Sir Edward Grey. He wrote a lot. He was he died in 1933. So he wrote quite a lot after the war about that period. So I was able to put it together from a variety of different sources. But yes, I wanted to. The aim of all this is to try and sort of say that you know, that all these films and these depictions, it's All Quiet on the Western Front, it was a massive hit for Netflix over Christmas and New Year. And again, you know, no birds in it, no bird song anywhere. And you know, and film producers and others always want to give this impression that when the guns weren't pounding and they weren't killing each other, there was nothing going on. And that simply isn't true. No Man's Land was quite alive with wildlife, ironically. And I think it'd just be nice to see it portrayed in one film or you know, in the future, where it's a bit more accurate representation of what was actually going on there.
Yeah, yes, I agree, absolutely. Well, the book is called, for our listeners, The Role of Birds in World War One: How Ornithology Helped to Win the Great War. It's by Nicholas Milton, who we're chatting to now. Actually, I've got that it's not out until the end of January. Is that correct?
No, it's out at the moment.
Oh, so, jolly good.
Pen and sword. No. Pen and sword. It came out last year. No, it's fine.
Great stuff. I've got January the 31st, 2023, but it's obviously the wrong information. So people can go out and buy it now.
They can indeed, yes, if they just look online at the Pen and Sword. And there's just one other very quick anecdote I wanted to tell you about, which was there was a private in the Royal Artillery, and they had this howitzer, this 4.5-inch howitzer that they used to pound the German lines with day and night. They used to have to disguise them from enemy planes, so he covered them all in sticks and branches and stuff like that. And this blackbird decided to get its nest inside his howitzer, and he was absent. There were six of them. This was a horse-drawn howitzer. And he said the noise when they fired, it was absolutely deafening. But one day they looked in there, and she'd built a nest with two eggs. And then he said, you know, and then there was a slight lull in the fighting. And then the next day, you know, he noticed there were five eggs in there. And they adopted this bird. This bird became their seventh member of the team. And they would sort of, and you know, because they put all their hope in this blackbird bringing up these youngsters, because, you know, and they would sort of, and he got permission to stop firing if she was sitting on the nest. So she used to hop off, and then they used to fire the gun, you know, which is just so sweet. And you can sort of see how that might have given them some hope. What was going on all around them, they pinned their hopes for the future on this poor little blackbird, you know, which and unfortunately, you know, we don't know what we know, that, you know, that she got on the five eggs, and but we don't have the follow-up letters to say whether or not she got those young off. But I like to think she did, because I think if they adopted her, you know, that would have, and it's little stories like that I think just give a slightly different dimension to the First World War.
It's true, and like you say, the films don't depict it, the books don't depict it, but, you know, obviously it was horrific what these poor men had to go through, but there were little tiny bits that we don't know about that you're bringing to life now.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's what it was all about. It was about giving them some solace, giving them some hope, you know, and they saw nature carrying on. And for a lot of them, it reminded them of home. You know, they heard a robin singing, and it reminded them of the robin in the garden. You know, they had a canary they had canaries that they used to put down under the tunnels in the same way as in the mines to detect the build-up of gas and stuff like that. And that reminded them of the canary that was at home in their, you know, in an ornate cage in the parlour. It used to be a lot more common to keep sort of birds like that then. And they used to hear and a lot of them were thrilled at the number of nightingales and other birds, and nightingales got a really loud, explosive song. And, the guns used to be pounding away and they used to stop. And in those little periods of silence, the nightingale would start up again, you know. And I just think that's an amazing part of the war that's in all these letters and, that hasn't really been sort of written about very much. So that's why I wrote the book.
Yeah, well done you. Well, it's great to chat to you. It sounds like a very interesting read. Thank you for telling us a bit about it, Nicholas Milton.
No, thank you for your time. Thanks.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.